2025 was a pretty special year for you, getting elected to the House of Representatives and getting your feet under you in Congress. What are some of the big takeaways or some of the memories that you'll have with you of your first year?
Well, I feel really good about the work that my team has done this first year. In order to be successful at this job, in my opinion, you need to be able to represent your constituents well. And a key piece of that is staying in close contact with your constituents. And so we have had, you know, several dozens of roundtables around the state. We will have had our 8th FedorCheck Forum, a statewide discussion with people. We have had office hours where I've had many one-on-one meetings with individuals, just crisscrossing the state constantly when I'm not out in D.C. So I feel like we've done a great job of, you know, understanding what people care about and trying to reflect that in our work. I know times are tough in agriculture, have worked hard on the trade side of things. Beef, we engaged quickly with the administration in the One Big Beautiful Bill. We passed probably 2/3 of the farm bill. So that's a big, you know, long-term support for our ag community. More work to be done there, but really, you know, in close contact with our ag community. On energy side, we've rolled back lots of the very onerous regulations that were strangling our energy producers. We eliminated the production tax credits for wind and solar that were 30 years in service, and costing our taxpayers a lot, and also causing the premature retirement of a lot of good dispatchable resources that we need for power.
Yes.
So that's good, and hopefully long-term will help on the affordability side. Working hard, we passed the largest tax cut in U.S. history. Citizens and North Dakotans will be feeling that in their 2026 tax returns. Should be the largest tax returns that North Dakotans across the board receive. So, you know, from an affordability side, from a competitive side, from a North Dakota key industry side, we've just really worked hard to be very targeted and get things done. And, you know, I see lots more to do, but I'm excited about the results that we've had so far.
What has been the maybe something that has been difficult about the job that maybe you didn't expect until you got out there and kind of got a few laps around the track, but something that as you look at it now, you go, this part of the job is difficult, and I'm not sure that I quite got it until I got out here and started doing this?
Well, it's a numbers game. And so you can have all the ideas in your head about what needs to happen and what should happen, and, you know, you can feel super passionate about it. But until you can get the 218 votes in the House and 60 votes in the Senate, that's all it is an idea. So you have to be able to build those relationships, work those relationships, build coalitions outside of the Hill to build support for the things that you want to get done. And so I knew that, but things happen slower than I would like. And so I think that that's, you know, I've had to take a step back and be a little bit more patient in that, like, yes, some of these bigger policies are going to take a little longer to get done. But we, you know, are very strategic and trying to use our time wisely and identify what the key folks are to get the things, our priorities finished. Another big setback, I would say, for me was the shutdown. I did not think that the Democrats would do it, quite honestly. I think I was naive about how much they were willing to tolerate the political, you know, just a flat-out political calculation for their own political gain at the expense of Americans. And so I thought that was very discouraging. It slowed us down. It stopped some of us, our momentum, and we're just getting wound back up now and getting rolling again and getting our agenda back on track. And so that was, you know, something that it's just not logical to me. I'm a logical person. I'm also just action-oriented, and sitting around having the Dems sit around for, you know, 8 weeks, dragging things out like that for no gain whatsoever is just unfathomable to me. So that's frustrating and was discouraging. But moving on from that now.
Yeah, right. Speaking of moving on, you are introducing a bill today called the FAIR Act. And this, I think those of us that believe the climate change clamor is mostly hoax and not a whole lot of reality here. A lot of us are pumping our fists when we see things like this happen in D.C., talking about getting all these states like Minnesota that have all these wonderful climate goals and green energy goals. They're going to try to pass the costs on to other states like North Dakota and make it more expensive for North Dakota companies and North Dakota producers to provide that energy. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing there.
Absolutely. The FAIR Act is a simple bill, and nobody should be opposed to it, but the Democrats will be. And it basically says that if for states, you can have whatever goal you want as it relates to your energy mix, but you need to pay for it. And that, as it relates to transmission lines, the power lines that get the power from one place to the next, the green energy mandates that Minnesota has requires them to build a massive amount of transmission to meet those goals and pull that energy in from out of states, other states. And if they want to do that, they need to pay for it rather than pass those costs along to all the customers in the MISO footprint, which North Dakota is part of. And there's a regime already in place that would require them or allow them to pass those costs on to other states like North Dakota. And we're fighting that in North Dakota's fighting that in FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And what my bill does is basically takes the same concept of what we're as a state fighting at the federal level in the regulatory manner and bakes it into law and requires that power lines need to be allocated and paid for. The cost of them need to be paid for by the customers that are that are causing those costs. And so it's a simple, straightforward thing. I think it would be huge if we could get it passed in the House and the Senate and baked into law, because it would do a lot to correct kind of the imbalances that are occurring in energy markets. It would make the states think twice about some of their policies if they had to bear the full cost of them themselves. And I think it would help reduce the increase in costs that people across our country are seeing in their energy rates, a lot of which is being driven by transmission.
Mm-hmm. Well, and your background in the Public Service Commission certainly prepares you well to have those kind of conversations. So we're glad that you're fighting those fights out in D.C. So we'll look forward to see what happens there. And like you said, you've got to get the 218 and the 60 to get anything done. So we'll hope that you do on that one, because that's going to be hopefully something that common sense Americans can say, yeah, that makes sense to me. I want to ask you a little bit about some immigration storylines that are percolating, I might say, from here over the last week or so. What's happened in Minnesota? I know you're not tied to Minnesota, but I'm a Minnesota, I'm a Twin Cities kid. I grew up down there, and Minnesota's a big part of our listening area here, obviously, in Fargo-Moorhead. And seeing the absolute magnitude of the fraud, and I don't know if you want to call it the corruption or if it's just incompetence or whatever, but what has happened with public money, basically a tax money that you and I are paying for, some federal tax money, coming back to Minnesota, then being routed to overseas terrorist groups in Somalia. This is something you think you're reading like a Babylon Bee headline, and you're not. It's real. And that's going on at the same time now that we're finding out New York Times did a big expose over the weekend on this parole scheme that Joe Biden and his administration put together to just import millions of illegal people to our country. I guess I'll just ask you for a comment on this as a big issue. How big of a problem is this? And then what can Congress do to help the president? Because it seems like he's very much willing to say, look, you might be a good person. It doesn't matter. If you're here illegally, we may have to get everybody out of the country and then start over again with a solid immigration policy. How can Congress help underpin the president on that?
Well, this is a huge problem. It's massive, and it's why the Republicans from day one were focused on shutting down the border, making sure that we're enforcing our country's laws at the border after 4 years of the last administration not enforcing the U.S. laws, and going beyond, like you said, and aggressively bringing in non-U.S. citizens, people from other countries, through these programs like parole and temporary protected status and other tools that are meant to help people in trouble. But they brought in massive numbers, far beyond what we could possibly scrutinize and vet properly. And we are paying that price. We are paying the price dearly. Some citizens in our country are paying the absolute ultimate price in the loss of their loved ones at the hands of some of these people who got in here and were not properly vetted. It's absolutely disgusting. It has to stop. A lot of that has stopped. And now we're trying to unwind it all and figure out, like, who's, you know, who needs to go immediately? Who needs more vetting? All of these sorts of things. We gave the president a lot of money in the One Big Beautiful Bill. I think it was something like $150 billion to support these efforts, both at the Border Patrol and through Homeland Security, to do this work and to do it well on behalf of the citizens of this country who are counting on it being done. And so that's, you know, step one. And we're also looking at, you know, reforming the immigration laws. There's a bunch of different proposals out there. Some of them require everyone to be removed and start fresh. Some of them look at, you know, more of a case-by-case situation and look at, like, do some of these people, can they stay here, pay a fine for coming here illegally? But if they're here and working and not causing trouble and not breaking our laws and you know, trying to be productive Americans and committed to being Americans, could they stay, pay a fine, you know, help with workforce issues, those sorts of things? So there's a variety of different proposals circulating, and it is a policy, a discussion that is very much at play right now as we speak.
So as we're almost one-fourth of the way through the Trump administration and to this, you know, half the way through the term of Congress and one-fourth away for the senators, do you sense that there's still that kind of passion and commitment on behalf of Republicans in D.C. to make sure that this effort does not lose any steam? Do you still feel good about the commitment level?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, somebody just across town, those two young guardsmen were shot down in Washington, D.C. by a non-American citizen, an Afghan. So, yeah, absolutely. It's front and center. We see it all the time. And I think I don't sense any backing off on my colleagues' interest in doing this and doing it right.
Very good. Julie, have you got time for a call? Perry would like to call and ask a question on immigration. You got time for us?
Sure.
Okay, Perry, go ahead. You're on with Congresswoman Fedorchuk.
Thank you. I just want to say that this isn't a new thing that's happening. I remember when I was a kid, 30 years ago, Lutheran Social Services in Fargo, in North Dakota, was bringing in so-called new Americans, many from Somalia and Africa in general. And they, whenever they were called on it, they always said, well, we're only bringing in 300 to 500 or 300 to 600 people per year. But this is 30, 40 years later. That's over 20,000 people into Fargo, and they've been procreating. And, I mean, this is a real problem that we are facing. And right. I want people to look at what's been happening long term instead of thinking this just started a couple of years ago.
Yeah, Perry, thanks for the call. It's a good point that it's been something that's been going on for quite some time. Thank you, Perry, for giving a call. Julie, any comments you'd have on that?
I appreciate that. Yeah, that is a good point. I think the scale of it was so much larger over the last 4 years, and there wasn't like the Lutheran Social Services and those organizations even doing kind of the vetting or the sponsoring and the, you know, acclimating and that sort of thing with what happened at such a large scale the last 4 years. So that's true. And all of that is being examined, and, you know, whatever changes in law are passed will apply to the entire system as a whole, including all of those organizations that often get involved in bringing immigrants to the country.
Yeah, I think in Fargo, if I remember right, it wasn't Somalians. It was people from Liberia and a couple other places. And so there, maybe it's a distinction without a difference. I don't know. But it seems to me that there's some different cultural nuances between those different groups. Julie, we got to let you go. I know you got a lot going on. Thanks for giving us a couple extra minutes today. We appreciate it very much.
Always good to visit, Steve. Thank you.
You too. Thanks. Take care, Julie.